this is the right place of all. Hello, this is a case of family history thinly disguised as a short story. A 30s romance. When she met a surgeon at the dance, Hetty Murphy was a recent graduate. Some months later, they became engaged to be married. Jim was the superintendent of a hospital up the country. A beautiful Georgian house went with the job. There were two maids. Hetty had had to have a difficult operation for appendicitis, still a killer at the time. She asked to be allowed to convalesce in his home. This was awkward, but Hetty was persistent. Two maids did not constitute a chaperone, a one-off thing, so he invited his mother to stay. She was unhappy at the arrangement, but went along with it. When it was time for Hetty to go home, her family came to Petra. They stayed the weekend before they left. The whole episode was an eye-opener for Jim. He discussed the situation with his mother. A week later, a letter to Hetty broke off the engagement. He asked her to return the ring. Her disappointment can be imagined. She was quite furious with rage. She wanted nothing less than to sue for breach of promise of marriage. Had she really loved him, one might well ask? With considerable difficulty, she was dissuaded from this course of action. Then an idea formed in her head. She would become a doctor herself. She would show him. This was more difficult to resist. Her own doctor, a cousin of theirs, begged her not to. Her father gave in. Hetty was his firstborn, his favorite. He could refuse her nothing. Medicine was shorter in those days. In her fourth year, Hetty failed an exam. She cracked up badly. Her examination had ended in tears. Her ambition had ended in tears. Jim married and was seen years later in the lounge of a Dublin hotel with his wife and children. When Hetty's sister's house was being cleared out quite recently, a box of photographs turned up. It contained four professionally taken prints by guides of Cork, each in a folder and covered with tissue paper. They showed a young woman, handsome rather than pretty, in costumes for day, luncheon, cocktails, and evening wear. They were in the high fashion of the period. Some suited Hetty better than others. She had never married.
Thank you very much, Charles, and now we have Dawn.
This is thank you. This is from a longish short story. It's just a short section from it. I read the first part a couple of weeks ago, and this is the second part. I'm not sure how much sense it'll make, but if you haven't heard the first part, but it doesn't matter. Well, that explained it. I wondered why this beautiful girl had come up to me and taken me home. Knowing this made me feel more comfortable with the situation. I wasn't a great conversationalist, and don't presume to be a great lover. I already knew that this affair we were having didn't have a lot to do with me. I was in the right place, at the right time, that's all. The place was a bar near Cork Institute of Technology, I can't remember its name, and the year was 1994. I was nearing the end of a lonely and fairly pointless semester in Ireland. The courses I was attending didn't really complement my mechanical engineering studies back in Oldenburg, and I didn't make any friends. Cork wasn't a place that made me happy. Whatever it was that had made me apply for a semester abroad hadn't been satisfied by the experience. So I studied my engineering textbooks like I never had before and worked hard on my English. And in the evenings, when it wasn't raining, I went for long walks. On one of those walks, it started to lash rain and I took shelter in a pub. I was sitting at the bar in my steamed up glasses and dripping wind cheater when she came up to me and talked 19 to the dozen. You can blame my dictionary if no one actually uses that expression. She invited me over to the group, and they were a friendly bunch. There was even another German who studiously ignored me. One of the guys there was called Francis, and Anya was in love with him, as I found out later. Obviously that accounts for why she picked me up in the first place, to make Francis jealous. But you can make a lover jealous just by flirting with someone else. She didn't have to screw me every night for a week. For that, I can only thank the melancholy Frenchman and Felix Mendelssohn. The love story was between her and Francis, though, and one evening he called to her door and they whispered urgently there for an hour. The next day, she didn't answer when I knocked and got angry with me when I turned up at the music building. Looking back now, all I feel for Anya is gratitude. She gave me exactly what I needed at that time, sexual experience. I had slept with a couple of girls before, but that was teenage stuff. After the week with Anya, I was ready for the adult world of sexual relations. And a few years later, when it came to seducing my wife, I was drawing on confidence Anya had given me. At the time, though, when being given the show for Francis, I was invaded by feelings that belonged more to the comedy of love than to my actual situation. I'm not proud to admit that the last time I spoke to Anya, I scolded her and accused her of using me. And if that wasn't petty enough, the last words I ever spoke to her were, "You should really clean your room."
Oh. Thank you, Donald. And next we have Conor McManus.
Thanks for the poem. The title of this poem is a play on Billy O'Callaghan's, the title of Billy O'Callaghan's latest book, The Things We Lose, The Things We Leave Behind. The poem is called The Things People Lose and The Shit They Leave Behind. You could find anything on the back seat of a taxi at the end of a night, but no money, no, never any money. Bits of burger lettuce, a perfume bottle, pine needles, french fries, a coconut, and a dog groomer from the Rochestown Road, huddled. I don't know how long he'd been there. It had been a very busy Saturday night. The wife was away and he'd taken the day off. He'd gone drinking early. Too early, maybe, he said.
Right, so many more poems, I hope, from the back of the cab, Colin. Next we have somebody who has drawn a face with a beard. So I presume that's John McNally. So.
I've got to read another poem, but inspired by your talk about hope, it reminded me of a poem I wrote a long time ago, so you have to apologise for its terribleness. It's called Outlet, and you might recognise some of this. On Hopehead Walk along the cliff path, you'll eventually see the outlet, our nation's epitaph. A boiling, bubbling, sewage-spewing jacuzzi atop the bobbing, squawking seagulls and their consort floozies. Under the gaze of squatting Gabe, Ojo, Duffy, Pat Kenny and other trusting goons, those that stir the shit should have to lick the spoon.
Right, I'm not sure we should thank you for that. Deirdre O'Brien is there.
The sea. This giant sleeps eternally, a restless, moving sleep, breathe heavy and deep, pounding breaths that overreach the washed up debris on the beach. Too far, you breathe too far, too late, drowning an instant in a shallow rock pool, your water still and ready to stagnate here at my feet. Constant eager, constant flow, never rest, one breath smothered by the next. Collapsing gladly, tumbling, fling the seaweed to the shore, then drag it back to fling it up once more. There is a cold and cutting wind, and a lone seagull beats an exit overhead. Now you are a murky green, pierced by breakers sharp and clean. The sun breaks through the clouds' distress, reflected instantly in a dazzling silver dress, invite me in to sink or swim. Out on this rock, wind and spray on my face, one slip now and I'm out of the race. Out of my depth at any rate, and what is that, 5'2" with heels, maybe 5'7" or 8"? Way beyond my comfort zone, and I'm thinking like the seagull, will I beat an exit home? Then you offer me your optical illusion to pin my hopes on that far-off confusion, that special place where sky and sea look like they meet but don't. I want to reach your horizon, but I won't.
Thank you, Jordan. And next we have Max Wheaton.
I never know what I'm going to do with my end up here. I'm going to do this fast because I did it with courage first, and I think it's for my sister in Toronto, and I love her a lot. And she rang me and she said something on the phone I thought was so beautiful that it sounds like a poem, and I got noticed better it is actually a song. So I think my tubes are going to go shortly, so I said I'll sing this fast for her, okay? She fell in love with a Canadian and she went over Iceland to up the San Lawrence River. We never got home for the last 40 years. We talk a lot. A hummingbird suckled on a honeysuckle tree in their garden in Toronto. Okay, let's start again. And he tell her. And a red cardinal bird cocked his head at every word that was spoken. Hearts broken, and he'd know it. And the raccoon's July, June was his bark, to sing, oh sweet twice, exit to the dark. And Aidan played Rocky Raccoon on guitar, and Nora'd sing, dance, dance to my 10 guitars. A hummingbird suckled on a honeysuckle tree, after 40 years of true loving her, he disappears, and she was ready, and sang her soul away. So that's Minora.
No.
And I'll be fast. This is just myself and Georgia, see women's synchronicity. We're both at St. Peter, we the same thing last night. So this is just Gary Lucas last night at 8:30, but I like to be fresh. He too has reached his end of days, my beloved collie, drifts and jack knives his downhill trail to Gary Lucas. The sun hovers, and its ebbing, tiding, fading to pale blue, rising to blend as lilac and watery pink, all collected by a shard of slate stratus. It sealed their horizon with an extended finger. Seashell, song of echoes of past times. When I first saw the three white stallions in summer's first light, a Scotswoman put them through their morning splashing runs through the waves, aligning manes with the rolling white trims. My son was already caddying for expats and stockbrokers who had flats for morning sweeps, bottomless accounts and September holidays from grinding infinite number crunching. I'd leave him to walk this little Celtic dream in the mornings against the dawn rose to strengthen my resolve for my poor damaged charges who'd await me each day. Now here it is dusk. Rocky still smiles to lift his little doggy floppy lips and sniffs in through a minty, refreshing, low ocean breeze, and it combs his gentle, silky little mane backwards. He even breaks into a trot, a late awakening of youthful urges. Soon he spots a pretty lad bitch, but too inertial from his years, he lets his frisky son be about his father's business. The old dog looks at me in a sad, accepting way, which it is. Both us two, we see the beauty of a reflected moon on a cling film of cool, damp sand. A frozen sheet of thin ice seems to cover the evening beach as fresh streams flow on their sheets across to fill the outward tide. Rocky and I see the two moons, and I think he knows too, as again he seeks my eyes. Bobby is silent beside me, in his way. I search his memories to tell me of when he fished for the Lucy, when he fished for a shark. The calmness, he said. No wonder what, no matter what way the seas were, it never felt the same on land. He loved too the run of the tide and how it became turbulent to the fock of the old head. The leeward side would be flat calm, and the meetings of the waters thrilled the returning sailors with its turbid waters. the bale rotten. The freckled mouth was their sturdy vessel, and she loved the sonic changes beneath her. She sniffed out the little holy grail of turbot and haddock with God's thumpent. She landed the centurion medal from my Bob's shark. She prepared her cargo for the Championnade Monde and produced a world-class fisherman in my guy. Sometimes she too searched for the distress signals and lofted ailing fishermen aboard and ashore to safe haven. His voice was quiet and he was nostalgic. Barry was gone. He broke his comrade's heart. The shadow through the window on the stormy, icy January morning stained their years of joy. It would never hold the same place in their hearts now, and the ocean said farewell to the bale bracken. But he was at peace too near the sea. And as we walk up the promontory, I see poor old Rocky just squatting down the comfort of the grasses. His back legs have begun to give as his bunny hops and scissor walks. I lift his aging, tender frame, and he let me. Never before would he surrender. No, it was his relief. My partners through the year were my two silent witnesses to these two beaches, as Molly's beach now beckoned, and Rocky Valley to fall with gravity down the steep steps. It is the last of the light, but no urban ribbon of high-rise blockades our horizon. The rim of the cliffs and the fields are low, and let sun have its last hurrah of the day. The light stays with us till our return. A little benediction of the Queen of Heaven, the Ocean Star, was our first lantern to light to guide us forward in love. Have a flat night.
Could I just ask you to keep it to one
poem?
Yeah, that's okay. We're just running out of time. Patricia Walsh is next.
This is a piece of my novel. It's called The Quest for the Lost Area. It's about a set of twins who find themselves in an archaeological dig, and you find out that parts of archaeology is totally different from what they expected. And so this is their first day of work. At 7:30 a.m., the twins got picked up at the monument for Sarah and Greg, as directed. Although an idle gang had ever met before, it stood to reason that you never miss anybody driving towards you wearing a fluorescent yellow fizz vest, especially with the art monitor in the buttonhole. Sarah was dread driving and chain smoking at the same time, while Greg was making it obvious that he was biting his lip. Because it seemed to the twins that if he had said so much of a word in his defence, there'd be hell to pay. The car trundled dutifully on the slip road and eventually along the route 666, as directed, and was not long before they arrived in the outskirts of the town, passing the Bronte Brothers bookshop, Cassidy's Bar, and the Get Stuff restaurant on the right. "Is this why you got there?" inquired Paul. "Yeah," put Greg, "but the sidewalk's excavating is just around the road, it's not far." The car poodled on, eventually arriving in front of Galvez Gate, and the sound of crunching and hardcore beneath the tires. Greg got out and opened the agonizing creaky Galvez Gate. When Sarah parked the car, she rolled down the little window and lit another cigarette. Paul gingerly broached the local archaeology with her. "You see that castle over there?" "Yes." "What's the history behind it?" "Don't know." "Have you ever been up there, even on your lunch break?" "No, the director doesn't allow us to go there. Insurance reasons, you know. And it's a small matter of trespassing private land." John decided to pause the conversation. "Who's funding this venture? What's going to be built?" Sarah pointed a badly torn poster fluttering in the breeze. "You see the poster over there? There's Ross and Gunnar. They're funding a job here." John looked at the rag of the poster more closely, expecting four smiley faces dressed in various work hats at right angles to one another, with the caption at the bottom, "Appetite for Construction." Paul begged for the window to be shut. "God, there's an awful smell out there. I bet somebody died." Greg piped up. "Well, that's a nighttime cheese factory for you, or nightmares of the snow. Legend has it that nobody had a peaceful night here to sleep here since it closed down." "Why?" "Something to do with eating cheese for your supper. The workers in the cheese factory used to get free boxes of cheese and they used to eat them when they got home. It was like ice living dead or so hard. So it haunted," said John. "Apparently," said Greg, "it's populated by a supernatural giant cow who invades, decides, and terrorizes anybody who comes in her way." "Why is that?" Well, somebody told me that the refractory Ranjanation Christian burial ground on Selwood Street went supreme. And when it was being built, the owner of the company that got built paid good money to cover the archaeology up. She's been there ever since terrorising the locals. Is that true? Of course, that was in the 1960s when people stopped believing in fairies and magical ring force and more in the power of money. Still, I wouldn't worry about it. Are we actually excavating that? No, thankfully, we're just a few hundred yards from it. Can we go to the factory? No, again, there's insurance reasons. The time lapse are all here, over here anyway. It's that near, thanks.
Thanks, Bishop, and I hope you read from that next time, and so we can find out what happened next. And it's Seamus Harrington.
This Revive January 2010. It was Revive, past tense, not there anymore. I was visiting somebody in hospital a good few years back, and it was a very old building, a narrow corridor, and right in front of me, somebody sitting in a wheelchair, staring down at the other end of the corridor, a wheelchair, somebody facing the other way. And I think they were trying to gauge where would they pass. There was a layby at the nurse's station halfway along. But I thought, perhaps to the shootout. It's called High Noon. Cocooned in a gown of dragons, staring, he sits in the hallway, right thumb on a rim. Morricone fading away from the remote day room TV. The other one, cumbersome, dissecting his cardigan, a sandaled foot on each wrist, a waft of brown soda, pungent and poignant as cordite. Unaware of the danger, a patron at peace with the world, plods between the parked chairs, puckers his lips, pockets a tissue of teat. Kaleidoscopic wall hanging, the stained slash of sunlight, seraphic, sacred and silent. Unblinking, they face one another. Who'll draw that first bead? 20 chrome revs apart, Derringers still trousered. A clumsy bedpan bongs clear as an angelus bell. Two right hands lift as one.
Thanks, Seamus. Okay, and next we have Richard. What's your last name, Richard? Keane, is it?
Keane,
yeah.
The fund actually kind of started last week. It's Paul started this, so kind of Paul's, all Paul's fault. It's because trying to speed us all up, you were saying a poem ahead. So it's kind of two poems in one, but it is one poem. A poem ahead, the price of admission. I admit I'm a poet. It's probably terminal. The report itself. A poem ahead was what the man said, because there isn't much time. No, not enough time to make it all rhyme. Yet the poem seed has been placed, now waiting. It will grow and develop. Sprouting legs to help it walk, hands to grab your attention, eyes to look deep into your soul and touch you. Right now there is no time for this maturity. Its infantile state needs a time we do not have. The clock ticks, time passes. I suggest we should wait, be patient. Till a later date, some future day, this poem in my head will have its say. Who knows where, who knows when or why. Maybe years from now, the world it may seek. Or maybe it will be ready to face you next week.
Good morning, Richard. And following that is Rob Orpart.
Thank was going to read them. I saw a short article from a book by Italo Calvino, but I forgot to bring the book, so you're just going to have to suffer me. Strip a bright sun on a wall, nature's budding, I can hear the spring call. Your smile lights up your eyes like a sunrise. I knew I love you. I love you madly, and I want you so badly. Shock drop closed on the floor, closing of the bathroom door. Your eyes light up your smile, they make me walk that extra mile. And ooh, I love you madly, and I want you so badly. And then fate stepped in and we parted ways, we lived separate lives on different days. The magic waned and the ice set in, but it never was like it never had been. And ooh, I love you madly, and I want you so badly. Subtle smell of scent on the breeze. I can't remember the rest of it.
Okay, well, you'll have to come back with that one later. And hopefully you'll remember to bring it with you. Next we have, probably for the first time, Philip Detzel. Probably from the back there somewhere.
Not my first time, but it's my last time, unfortunately. Going back, heartbreaking. I haven't been here for like 2 months, so it's alright. I've been on vacation, but this one's called Wednesday Clouds. There's very little you can do at 3 in the morning. On that cold Wednesday night, the frozen grass, we'll light another cigarette and search for the clouds of Magellan, knowing that they can't be seen in the February Vermont sky, then settling for Orion.
Well, that's great, Todd. I hope you come back someday soon. And I think maybe there's some. John Tortorello is next, I think. Are you together, maybe? I hope you're not leaving too.
Yes, this is my first and unfortunately my last as well.
Oh, no.
But, you know, I was encouraged to come here. This is a cool place. So this poem was about a lake, about a 6-hour drive north of New York City, not too far from Canada. The name of the lake is Big Moose Lake, and the poem is called May. When I live in the mountains that live in me shed flakes, like hothouse paint baked by the sun. Piling up on the earth like dry needles, bearing pine cones picked at by squirrels. Sappy needles will stick to the bottom of bare feet like a nail in our house. Exposed over time, the paint flakes away, a nail that my grandfather hit with his hammer before he knew anything more than the mountains. When a wave laps my toes like rustle the sheepdog with my legs after a long, salty run over unsalted gravel up hills so much steeper than the roughest strip of asphalt in Massachusetts. I know that these sand grains that touch everybody around this great puddle, and at the twitch of a neuron, I could paddle past every stick on the shore, step out and stand somewhere no one else has ever stood. How I hunger for the hum of the Johnson 9.9, when it burns away the hours of summer like a 20-foot bonfire, like to the tips of evergreen branches, like joints to their smoke billows high to the billions and millions of burning gas dots in the midnight sky. Each one tugging at the next sunrise like the pull cord on the morning engine. When the loon calls before I drift into dreams, the long, lonely note begs the question, why must it sing night after night to the emptiness of the rippling lake, whose depth depends on the daily rain, who sucks what sinks and spits what floats, who trembles in tumultuous winds and always lets out the river it lets in but never changes its name.
Well, thank you guys. Greetings back to the States. I know that part of the world quite well. My family's from New Jersey.
Woo!
We've all been to New Jersey, precise.
And tomorrow evening, we have Tally.
Thank you. I have a piece of prose. It's not too long. I know the book looks much thicker than the bottom actually reading. If it's too long, feel free to hit me on the back of the head.
Yeah.
The old man packed another book into a brown bag, smiled, raised a hand in goodbye and turned to the next customer. The cuckoo clock on the wall struck a crooked bell, drawing his attention. From across the road, Jim McGraw watched the old man. His old teacher, he corrected. Stay with the facts, his therapist always said. Gaze at the clock. His view was peppered, not just by passers-by, but by the scraps of tape and posters that decorated the shop window. Book Club seeks members. Open mic session at the LV. Owners seeking a missing dog and cat. There's a reward for the dog. The cat isn't so special. The shop was busy this morning, and Jim watched the easy movement of the clientele with interest. Post-incarceration, he enjoyed watching people go about everyday business. It felt exotic. For a moment, Jim wondered if any of the shop's clientele knew just how lucky they were. But then he had wondered the same thing many times since. On a rainy November day, he had exited the prison he had refused throughout his stay to call home. Prison does that to a man, his therapist had told him more than once. And those words swirled in Jim's mind as he watched the shop's customers glide past each other. Noting the silky adjustment shoppers made to pass each other, Jim began to relax. The tension had kept him coiled as tight as rubber bands in a golf ball since he had landed here in New York eased. His stomach unfurled a little. A soft breeze tickled his face. And enjoying the cool, light touch, Jim shut his eyes. For a moment, the demons he had battled to control for so many years hovered horribly on the edge of his mind. But then, as sunshine exploited a gap in the morning cloud, a smile flickered on his lips. Images of a sleek, glistening cod breaking a still lake, its tails frantically flapping at the air danced in his mind. He heard water splash on concrete and the dull thud of a wooden club. He saw a leatherman slip effortlessly along the shimmering gut, entrails spill onto concrete, blood licking cracks. And then he heard his mother scream, as she always did, when the listless form was waved beneath her nose, and the smack of lips that filled the kitchen as the catch was devoured. His smile broadened when the laughter danced round the table as they sang, fresh, dead fish, fresh, dead fish, peeled in his head. Jim opened his eyes as his old teacher exchanged books with a young man, waving hands and shaking heads animated their interaction. Jim chuckled at the theatrical actions of the younger protagonist. This guy, he could tell, would drive a hard bargain. Jim wondered if he would do the same. When the contract was agreed, both men smiled, shook hands, and the young man turned and made for the door. Outside, the morning cloud had dissipated beneath the rising sun as easily as the touch of a swiftly returning tide erodes children's sandcastles, and the street had been transformed. Chilled air and shaded footpaths had been replaced by humidity, and the street was now a hive of activity. When the young man paused in the doorway to remove his jacket, sunlight caught his face, colouring his skin a pale, almost sallow yellow. Watching, Jim felt his head spin. An image of blue-grey eyes, bordered by a labyrinth of creased skin, rose before him. Once again, he witnessed life fade in the iris, and the rasp, but grueling, not just in length, but volume too, welled in his ears. Suddenly breathless and glad of the stone wall that ran along the river, Jim winced at his mother's flooded, as his mother flooded his head. She had been a beautiful woman, and so the complications of Jim's life had engraved weariness on every movement and expression. Then she became bitter, twisted and distant, her only joy delivered by finding the bottom of a bottle. Jim, even when embroiled in his own downward spiral, had watched her diminish, and he had been there when the shame of his exposure had finally stopped her heart. Being there provided some consolation for his part in her spiral, but it had never been enough to prevent any thought or mention of her activating the image of that final breath, and the relief he felt swell as she slipped away. A petite blonde girl now joined the old man. They contrasted well behind the large oak dresser that served as a counter. One, with ceremonial shirt and tie, polished shoes and neatly groomed hair, provided a throwback to another generation, while the other, with her bright face, economical movement and casual jeans, was quintessentially product of today. Books large and small across the counter as Jim watched. The old man stacked exchanges to his left, below the large gold painted mirror Jim admired so much. The mirror dominated the wall behind the oak dresser, and Jim loved how, even from outside and despite the posters and sellotape, every corner of the shop was flaunted in its mottled glass. As he had some point every day, Jim imagined a CCTV control room hidden behind that mirror. The room was cramped, had papers strewn on the floor, and was dominated by a dozen TV screens mounted on the wall. A small, sharp-eyed man peered intently at the grimy screens. Below his raggedy chair, set into the floor, and concealed by an equally raggedy rug, was a safe that contained the most valuable item on the premises, a handwritten note addressed to Jim. Jim knew the note did not exist. If it did, the old man, his old teacher, Jim corrected again, had penned one he would receive it a long time ago, but it was a nice idea, and envisaging a tangible manifestation of his dilemma, mitigated his behaviour since he arrived outside the shop. It applied understanding to the fact that for almost a fortnight he had wandered, watched and waited without once coming close to doing what he had come to do, step inside. One second. I'll leave it at that. It's a bit long, yeah?